Now, from our state-of-the-art studios in Brawley, providing accurate and timely news and information to our blind and print-impaired audience, your North Carolina Reading Service, along with yours truly, John Federson, are presenting, are bringing to you... I'm going to have to go back and find out what it is I'm bringing. Oh, yes. It's the Indie Week from October the 13th, 2022. Thank you, musicians. I ran long on the intro, so I can't introduce you now. Thank you. We'll see you at the end of the show. Bye. Bye. That's good. All right. We will first go to the online edition, Indie Week, indieweek.com, and they have one day later information than in the print edition. So my first article is How to Vote in Wake County in this 2022 election, which is less than a month away. Here's everything you need to know about voting. Jasmine Gallup offers this. In the past year, almost 50,000 newcomers have moved to Raleigh, and for those making a home in a new state, it can be tricky to figure out how and when you should vote. That's not to mention all the high schoolers who have recently turned 18 and are now eligible to make their voices heard in elections. Even if you've already registered, it never hurts to check your registration online. Download a sample ballot or look up your polling place before Election Day. So here's the deadline for regular voting registration. If you want to register to vote before this Friday, you have a few different options. The quickest way is to register online through the Department of Motor Vehicles, DMV, website. You could also visit any Wake County Public Library to register or update your information as long as you're there before 5 p.m. Today, this is Thursday, the 13th. The 14th. Unregistered voters can also fill out a one-page form and mail, email, fax, or deliver it in person to the Wake County Board of Election. To mail, send to the Wake County Board of Elections, Post Office 695, Raleigh, North Carolina 27602. Ensure that the letter is postmarked by October 14. To email, it's got to be to voter@wakegov.com by 5 p.m. October 14. You may be listening to this after that fact, and too bad. Now, there is October 20th. This is a deadline for one-stop early voting starts. Not the deadline, it's when it starts. If you miss the 14th deadline, don't worry. You can still register to vote and cast your vote at one of Wake County's one-stop early voting sites. Wake County has a useful online tool for finding the site closest to you and viewing the estimated wait time. That website also lets you look up hours the sites are open and driving directions. The early 15 early voting sites, which are open October 20th through November 5th, are listed here. Hours are as follows for them. Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. Saturdays, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. And Sundays, 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. Early voting, this is from the Wake County, wakegov.com departments, and it's, you can find on their general website, early voting and election day voting, etc. Early voting site. This is from October 20th through November 5th. Avery Street Recreation Center, the Carey Senior Center, Green Road Community Center, Herbert Young Community Center, Hilltop Needmore Town Park and Preserve, Chavis Memorial Park, John Brown Community Center, Lake Lynn, L-Y-N-N Community Center, NC North Carolina State Tally Student Union, Northern Regional Center, Optimist Park Community Center, Southeast Raleigh YMCA, the Board of Elections Office Downtown, Hunt Recreation Center, and Wendell Community Center. And this place, if you want more detail, you can get the addresses of all of these locations with the hours I described a moment ago. To sign, again, you send, if you want a one-page form to register before, it's probably not going to work. The earliest this broadcast comes on is Friday, so we won't bother you with that. So that's now November the 1st. We are moved up to November the 1st. That's the deadline to request an absentee ballot. If you'd like to vote by mail, you have to request a ballot by November 1. You can submit a request online. I'll give you that in a moment, or mail a form to the Wake County Board of Elections, Post Office 695, Raleigh 27602. And again, the North Carolina State Board of Elections has votebymail.ncsbe.gov/app/home. votebymail.ncsbe.gov/app/home. The absentee ballot portal. You can request a ballot. You can access military or overseas voter services. If you are a visually impaired voter who has requested an accessible ballot and have been informed that it is available, select this option, the accessible ballot, to access your ballot. If you'd like to learn more about how this option works before you access it, they give you a link to practice with a demo ballot. The deadline to complete and return that absentee by mail ballot is 5 p.m. on Election Day. If you are blind or visually impaired and need assistance with this portal, contact Matt Stone, who is the ADA coordinator, at adacoordinator@ncsbe.gov. Phone number 919-805-1302. And is located at 6400 Mail Service Center, Raleigh, 27699-6400. That's the zip. Any voter can use a sample ballot. And then this portal, which I've given you, has options at the bottom. Sample ballot, accessible ballot, overseas ballot, and requesting an absentee ballot. So that's November 1 is the deadline to request that. Now, November the 5th, one stop, early voting ends. Oh, let's see. Excuse me, I missed this. After you've requested your absentee ballot and have gotten it and filled out, you can return your ballot by mail or in person. Mail your ballot with a first-class stamp or a forever stamp to the Wake County Board of Elections. I've given you that address already. To deliver in person, you can drop off your ballot in person at the Board of Elections or any early voting locations, and I've given those to you. November 5th, the one stop, early voting ends. It ends November 5th, but as long as you are in line by 3 p.m., you have the right to vote. Finally, November 8th is Election Day. Polls are open from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. As long as you're in line by 7:30 p.m., you have the right to vote. You can look up your polling place and view a sample ballot. Here and there is again, which is a website called vt.ncsbe.gov/REGLKUP. Reg lookup, REGLKUP. That will take you to a voter search. When you type in your voter details, you give your name, last name, and it will tell you where your voting site is. So that's all very handy. And that's it for this article about voting for this election, which you may or may not know is quite important to the state and to your community here. Continuing now, Jasmine Gallup. writes, Wake County Habitat for Humanity questions candidates on affordable housing. And they read, wondering where your local candidates stand on affordable housing? Habitat Wake asked candidates for the Board of Commissioners in Wake County and the Raleigh City Council about their stances on growth, displacement, rent prices, property taxes, and racial equity. As rent keep rising and more people move to the Triangle, most local candidates are promising to address the housing crisis if they're elected in November. But what are their actual plans to give people more affordable homes? Jackie Ayala, Director of Advocacy at Habitat for Humanity of Wake County, says, This election comes at a critical time for affordable housing locally. We know that voters are feeling and seeing the negative impact of rising housing costs, so we want to make sure they have housing in mind at the ballot box. Habitat Wake asked every local candidate about their approach to the housing crisis this month, focusing on growth, displacement, rent prices, property taxes, and racial equity. 33 candidates for the Wake County Board of Commissioners, Raleigh Mayor, and Raleigh City Council responded. From the county, every candidate responded to Habitat Wake's questionnaire. There are 7 candidates running this year, and they are in District 1, 2, 3, and 7. The incumbent in District 7, Vicki Adamson, is running unopposed. Matt Calabria, the only other incumbent running for re-election this year, says Wake County has taken aggressive steps forward in addressing the housing crisis, including working with cities to enact modern zoning ordinances, building 2,500 affordable housing units in 3 years, and working to preserve naturally occurring affordable housing. He plans to stay the course and expand existing programs. His opponent in District 2, Mark McMains, says the county should invest in tiny homes and work to unite the county cities and towns on the issue. In District 1, candidate Chanel Harris is focused on help for first-time homebuyers, including providing information on searching for a home and financial support. Her opponent, Don Miel, M-I-A-L, says he wants the county's cities and towns to contribute to an affordable housing plan, convening a task force to develop something everyone can support. Miel is also in favor of a housing-first approach to helping the homeless and mentions protecting the county's water supply and green spaces. In District 3, candidate Irina Comer is in favor of upzoning for denser housing, like duplex and multiplex, saying the single biggest affordable housing challenge facing Wake County is supply. Comer aims to lower property taxes and promote equitable housing access. Comer's opponent, Cheryl Stallings, supports many of the county's current housing policies and says she will continue to work with the federal government and local nonprofits as well as expand existing programs. She plans to prioritize land acquisition and lower property taxes. Now, that's the county. How about the city? As expected, current mayor Mary Ann Baldwin made the case that the city's policies are working to address the housing crisis and touted the success over the past 2 years following the passage of the city's housing bond. Terrence Ruth, her primary challenger, promised to advocate for underrepresented Raleigh residents, including those facing higher property taxes and displacement. DeQuanta Copeland, third candidate for mayor, had brief answers, but promised to lobby the state for a cap on rental increases. Most of the city council candidates are divided into two camps. Those who support upzoning to allow developers to build denser housing, and those who oppose the city's pro-growth strategies, arguing council members should do more to protect existing single-family neighborhoods. And Habitat Wake wrote a questionnaire and has included in this article, if you go to IndyWeek online, this article gives you a link to that questionnaire and these answers to those specific questions. Again, from IndieWeek.com, the online version of our issue. This story originally published at North Carolina Policy Watch, and it's by Keelan Lyons. It's about how many people and who would benefit from marijuana pardons in the state. In 2019 alone, there were over 31,000 charges of possession of up to half an ounce of marijuana. That's the lowest level misdemeanor in the state. Of those charges, 8,500 resulted in convictions. This is 2019 alone. Last week, of course, Governor Cooper told members of the Task Force for Racial Equity and Criminal Justice that his lawyers were looking at convictions for simple marijuana possession to determine whether there's anything the executive branch can do, like issue a pardon, to follow the president's lead and help people convicted of low-level marijuana possession move on with their lives. Cooper did not provide any data that morning, but figures presented to a working group of the task force in November of 2020 offer a glimpse as to how many and who might benefit from pardons. Now, President Joe Biden announced last week he was issuing pardons for the simple possession of marijuana, affecting about 6,500 people convicted of the federal crime between 1992 and 2021. The crime is a federal misdemeanor. A person can be charged with simple possession if they have up to 4 ounces on them, resulting in a fine of at least $1,000 and could include prison time, although no one is currently serving time in federal prison solely for marijuana possession. Biden's pardon applies only to people convicted of the federal crimes. It does nothing for those convicted under state laws. In North Carolina in 2019, there were, as I said, 31,000 charges of possession of up to half an ounce that could result in a fine of up to $200, but no jail time. Of those 31,000, 8,500 resulted in convictions. More than 60% of those convicted of the crime were not white. That same year, there were 3,400 charges for possession of more than a half ounce, but less than 1.5 ounces, punishable by up to 45 days imprisonment and a $200 fine. Of those, 1,900 cases resulted in conviction. 70% of those convicted were not white. Almost 2,500 people were charged in 2019 with possession of more than 1.5, but less than 10 pounds, 1.5 ounces, but less than 10 pounds, which is a class 1 felony, punishable by up to 8 months in prison and a $1,000 fine. Of those 2,500 charges, 338 resulted in conviction, two-thirds of whom were not white. In their report issued a month later, the task force recommended legislators decriminalize marijuana possession of up to 1.5 ounces. Legislators did not act on this recommendation. Cooper said he supported decriminalization last week when he told task force members he was extending their work into 2024. And he quotes, "Law enforcement and the criminal justice system are under-resourced right now, and they should be focused on stopping violent crime, drug trafficking, and other threats to safe communities. We also know that a conviction of simple possession can mar people's records for life and maybe even prevent them from getting a job." And from Indie Week again, November's election could reshape the city council of Raleigh and the city itself. This by Jasmine Gallup. It's the height of campaign season, and Terrence Ruth, a mayoral candidate who has been campaigning for nearly 2 years now, is calm and collected as he answers questions about housing, community outreach, and social justice. He says, determined, "My vision for the city starts with community engagement. I think before we get to concrete policy, we have to seriously address the deficit of trust that starts with allowing residents to be seen and heard again." Ruth is a lecturer at North Carolina State University's School of Social Work. He's 39 and is the primary opponent of Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin in the race for the city's top seat. DaQuanta Copeland, a single mom and public health advocate, is also running for mayor. Baldwin, the incumbent, seems to have the most support so far, having raised about $700,000 with 590 individual contributors to her campaign. Ruth comes second with about $40,000, about 6% of Baldwin's total haul. Copeland has raised less than $100, according to campaign finance report. Ruth, like all challengers, is promising change. Baldwin and her coalition of supporters have dominated the city council since 2020, when three newcomers replaced development-skeptical incumbents. Since then, a block of six, sometimes seven, council members has typically supported Baldwin on issues ranging from affordable housing to community outreach. The 2022 election gives slow-growth candidates who are proponents of the city's officially disbanded Citizen Advisory Councils, that's CAC, the chance to retake the city council with neighborhoods and CAC advocates, in addition to grassroots social justice activists running in all five districts and at large. With three incumbents declining to run for re-election, Raleigh residents will see at least two new faces on the council come January, some of whom would likely push back on Baldwin's pro-growth agenda. But do the majority of voters agree that the city needs new leadership? Baldwin has amassed her fair share of critics, but she's also ushered in some significant successes and made strong efforts to address the main challenge facing the city today, the massive influx of people moving to the metro area, coupled with the city's shortage of housing. It's no secret that one of the biggest issues facing residents today is housing prices. From the Indies reporting in the last year, Tina Love Hinton, a mother of five, spent 8 months looking for her first home, outbid again and again by out-of-state transplants, willing to put down $30,000 or $40,000 in cash. Francisco Cerón Sagastume, a renter near Dix Park, was forced out of his home after it was sold to a developer planning to build a high-end apartment complex. Stories like this are not usual and unusual in Raleigh nowadays, and they speak to a common theme, a shortage of homes that middle-class workers can afford to rent or buy. Baldwin argues the solution to Raleigh's crisis is reforming zoning rules to allow more houses to be built, meeting the increased demand. In some ways, that strategy has worked. Since last year, the number of homes for sale has doubled in Wake County, going from 1,200 in August of 2020 to 2,500 in August of this year, according to Triangle MLS. That's a website that tracks home listings. The number of months it would take for Raleigh to sell out of homes has also increased from about 2 weeks to 6 weeks. And Baldwin touts the city's $80 million housing bond. The city is now on track to build 5,700 affordable housing units by 2026. The running total is currently 3,900, and the bond is also helping fund a home buyer assistance program and a home repair program. Baldwin says, "We have probably done more on housing affordability than any council has done in the past. We now allow for the construction of accessory dwelling units. We got rid of an exclusionary zoning, and we now allow missing middle housing, which gives people more of a choice in homes. The partnership with Campbell Law to prevent evictions, that's never been done before. We've really stepped it up in terms of looking at housing affordability and choice." She continues, "Raleigh is growing. We're the third fastest growing city in the country. And I know there are people who want to stop growth, but we can't stop growth. We have to plan for it." During her first year in office, Baldwin went to work as Director of Business Development for Barnhill Contracting, one of the largest builders in the Triangle, drawing criticism until she resigned a little over a year later. Before that, she worked for Holt Brothers Construction and as executive director of the company's foundation. Currently, she is the vice president of a nonprofit that helps children learn skills through golf. Some of Baldwin's top donors are executives of contracting and real estate development companies, but she has denied any connection between campaign contributions and policy decisions. She has also received $5,600 from the North Carolina Home Builders Association, PAC, a political action committee which advocates for pro-housing candidates, according to its website. The city has made a strong effort to build more affordable housing, but has not been able to keep up with escalating demand. Despite Baldwin's efforts, housing prices continue to soar, and much of Raleigh's existing affordable housing has disappeared. Even as the city builds thousands of new homes, nearly 9,000 affordable apartments have been lost just since 2019. This year, Raleigh has a deficit of nearly 20,000 affordable apartments, according to a report by United Way of the National Capital Area. In some ways, Ruth's approach to housing is similar to Baldwin's. Like the incumbent, he says he supports buying land for future affordable housing projects by the city, arguing the city can't control rent prices unless it controls the land. He supports investing more money in permanent supportive housing for the homeless and other vulnerable populations, but he also wants the city to be more aggressive in controlling where and what developers build. He says he wants to create affordable housing overlay districts, which provide additional incentives to developers to build affordable housing in certain areas. He says affordable housing overlay is critical, especially in areas where there's a high demand and high interest, like where there's bus rapid transit. New Bern and Method are two historically black communities. How do we demonstrate that the council is representing those voters? Ruth also thinks the city should follow Wake County's lead in creating an affordable housing department and use a new tracking system to see what existing housing may be going on the market. Finally, he wants to work more closely with developers and landlords who are willing to take on affordable housing projects, creating a database or pipeline to draw on. Community engagement and transparency isn't just a buzz phrase in this year's election, it's a central issue. Ever since the Raleigh City Council voted 6-2 to defund CACs, those neighborhood groups that met monthly to discuss community issues, but also a format residents used to oppose new development projects in 2020, many Raleighites say they have felt ignored. For the last 2 years, the most direct way to communicate with council members has been through public comment at meetings, which comes with strict rules and a 1 to 3 minute time limit on speaking. The council disbanded CACs, it appeared, but didn't seem in a rush to replace them with a new system of public outreach. After a year of inaction, also the year of the COVID pandemic, the city created the Office of Community Engagement in 2021, led by manager Tayshia Hinton. This year, the Community Engagement Board has started meeting, and communication between the city government and residents seems to be improving. The council recently added an option to leave public comments via voicemail, addressing concerns about people unable to attend meetings in person. But the limited means of engaging with the council since 2020 have fostered feelings of distrust among residents. Many continue to assert that their voices aren't being heard, and candidates are making community outreach a central campaign issue. Ruth is leading the charge. Quote, "Right now, as I'm going around the city, it feels like the weight of engagement is on the voter. If the voter doesn't attend the council meeting, they're unheard and unseen. That weight should be on the council and the mayor." He says engagement for the past few years has been primarily meeting-based. He wants to expand outreach to meet people in their communities. City staff should attend neighborhood gatherings and work with community leaders, he says. Staff should reach out to residents online and know whom to call if they need to hear the concerns of people in a particular area. Some city council candidates take a stronger stance, saying CACs should be refunded. Mary Black, running in District A for the seat currently held by Patrick Bufkin, who declined to run again, says CACs, some of which are still operating, need to be heard by the city council. She says, you don't get rid of an almost 50-year institution because there are some flaws in the way things work. Not having that engagement is going to increase the issues that we've already had here with unaffordability and overdevelopment in ways that don't work for the communities here and for the people that live in them. According to Baldwin, however, CACs are a thing of the past. Quote, in one survey we did, 90% of the people in Raleigh had never heard of a CAC or attended one, so it really was not an effective way of doing outreach. She added the city council made several attempts to reform CACs before defunding them, saying, quote, we had two studies on how we could enhance them, and we got very strong pushback both times from the CACs. Our decision to no longer fund was made because we believed we could do something better, and that's the path we're on right now. Obviously, COVID got in our way, but what we're looking at right now is more outreach in the community. Baldwin went on to describe a place-based outreach that matches Ruth's philosophy of meeting people where they are. Hinton has plans for mobile community engagement vehicles that will go into neighborhoods, according to the mayor. The vehicles will come equipped with computers and city staff to spread awareness about the activities of local government and get input from people. Baldwin says the other thing we're talking about is literally door-to-door communication, door knocking, going where people live and the places they frequent. So having meetings in dog parks, community centers, senior centers, it's really about getting out and engaging in a personal way, and that's what Tayshia Hinton is passionate about. Ultimately, most candidates running for office say they want the same things when it comes to community engagement. Comprehensive outreach programs that don't put additional burdens on residents and ensure the voices of minority populations are heard. But the unceremonious demise of CACs and frustration with how long it has taken to take even the smallest step forward has resulted in disagreements on the best ways to achieve community engagement. When it comes to building trust in the political process, the council has made its share of missteps, too. In the past 3 years, the council disbanded the CACs without notice, moved a city election in a closed-door meeting, and voted through new city districts opposed by local community groups based on U.S. Census data. The bill with election changes, Senate 722, was passed by the state legislature last June, and while rescheduling the election to an even-numbered year to coincide with the midterm wasn't necessarily a bad policy move, it gave city council incumbents a bonus year in office, an outcome that outraged some citizens. Likewise, allowing candidates to win future elections by plurality rather than majority may be more efficient, but it gives incumbents an edge, say critics. The nonpartisan good government advocacy nonprofit Democracy North Carolina, along with some local state lawmakers and Governor Cooper, took issue with that move. Josel Torres, the communications manager for that nonprofit, said Democracy North Carolina took an official opposition to SB 722 because of that permanent change about how Raleigh was going to elect its local officials. They basically gave themselves 12 more months in office without any public comment, without appropriate public notice either. Social justice. When George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police in 2020, Raleigh residents took to the streets for days to protest police violence and call for reform. 2 years later, however, not much has changed. Ruth says, we never had a conversation about community and policing in our city. We never reconciled that at all. We just moved forward. We needed to build a coalition and conversation about community and safety right now. We don't need to wait for another George Floyd. We need to reconcile those concerns of 2020, which we have not done. Following the protests in 2020, the city did replace its police chief. The former police chief, Cassandra Deck Brown, who was in charge when police officers and sheriff's deputies fired tear gas and non-lethal ammunition into crowds of protesters, retired last year to make way for Estella Patterson. The former city manager, Ruffin Hall, resigned at the end of 2020, following the protests as well. Ruth and Baldwin agree that Estella Patterson is passionate about community outreach. She's everywhere, Ruth says. Baldwin says, "One thing I love about Chief is that she's great with community relations and building trust. She is out there, and I think that's helped make a difference. October 15th was National Coffee with a Cop Day, so we had our officers out at six locations meeting with the community. Patterson was at the McDonald's on Poole Road, and she said it was packed." The city council has also expanded the ACORNS unit. That's a group of police officers and social workers who respond to mental health crises, Baldwin says. The council is also working with the NAACP and Moms Demand Action to reduce gun violence. But Black Lives Matter activists remain frustrated with the city council's overall policing policies, as well as the police department's nearly $8 million budget increase over the last fiscal year. A campaign earlier this year by community group Refund Raleigh to divest from the police force and invest in social services and non-police response units was essentially ignored by the city council, and police violence has not slowed. In the last 2 years, Raleigh police have shot and killed five people. Refund Raleigh is asking this year's city council candidates to vote against a 2023 budget that increases police spending and is working with the Wake County Sheriff's Office to cut ties with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Local social justice activist Ajamu Dillahunt says, quote, "The police cannot be a container for the things we need in order for our communities to thrive. The de-escalation that has supposedly been attempted is not just adequate, is just not adequate. The institution is deeply flawed and has a history of racist and brutalizing tactics." And I have a few more articles, several more actually, but I'm going to interject now a short article because the North Carolina State Fair, your state fair, is underway. It begins today, which is recording on the 14th of October. So Food and Drink has a little compilation by Lena Geller about food from the fair. There are 40 new dishes at the state fair this year, most of which look like they came straight out of a Chopped episode, so be sure to save some room for new traditions in between your Krispy Kreme cheeseburgers and your grist mill hush puppies. That fair runs October 13th through the 23rd. Here are five of our picks for the most innovative new menu items. And I'm reading this about lunchtime. I only hope that I'll make it through. Thanksgiving, stuffed turkey leg. That's a hickory tree turkey. A twist on the State Fair classic, this dish is best described as a Thanksgiving leftovers sandwich turned inside out with a hollowed-out smoked turkey leg instead of the typical stale bread roll, acting as a vehicle for stuffing, gravy, and cranberry sauce. I really like this idea, writes Lena Geller. Of putting stuffing between slices of bread has often seemed superfluous, and a turkey is such dry meat it makes more sense as a husk than a filling. Optional additional fillings include candied yams, collards, and mac and cheese. Pioneer Wagon offers rattlesnake corn dog. Rattlesnake meat is exceedingly bland. In the Southwest, it's often called desert whitefish. So the quality of this serpent on a stick will be governed by its seasoning. If the spice is right, the dish could be a menu highlight. If it lacks flavor, it will still come with the bonus of making you feel like Bear Grylls without having to drink your own pee. Well, we go to Pepsi Glazed Mini Donuts. That's the $2 S2 concessions. Our governor self-identifies as a diet soda sommelier and loves Keurig Dr. Pepper's Diet Sundrop, but North Carolina remains a Pepsi stronghold. If you worked at a North Carolina restaurant that doesn't serve Pepsi, you know this better than anyone. With a Pepsi-infused glaze and crunchy peanut topping, these donuts are a spectacular showcase of our state's food and drink culture. Two more to go. Douglas Farms offering Doriesquites. Roasted corn is another state fair classic, and this dish, de-cobbed Mexican street corn with crema, cotija cheese, hot sauce, and a squeeze of lime, served in a bag of crushed Doritos, offers an enticing enhancement. It's the best thing to happen to North Carolina Doritos lovers since 2006, when a beached cargo container spilled thousands of bags of Doritos onto the shores of Hatteras Island. Who can forget that, 2006? Finally, Ragin' Cajun, offering deep-fried country ham with peach bourbon jam. In August, the News and Observer reported the sad news that the State Fair's venerated country ham biscuit booth, operated by two Carey churches for more than a century, will not be returning to the fair this year. To soften the blow, head to the Ragin' Cajun booth for a new iteration of the beloved staple, deep-fried slices of local country ham served with a sweet and smoky peach bourbon jam. Chad Knuth, K-N-U-T-H, offers Beacon of Freedom about North Carolina's Freedom Park over in Raleigh. As Confederate statues continue to topple, the centerpiece of North Carolina's first monument to honor the African-American experience has finally been erected in Freedom Park, just one block from the state's Capitol building in downtown Raleigh. Reginald Hildebrand, a member of the Freedom Park Board of Directors, says this monument makes an important statement about freedom from the perspective of the black experience in a way that has not been done before. The park will offer visitors a space to gather to reflect on history and celebrate the future, and while the remainder of the park is still just shy of a year away from completion, the installation of the 40-foot-tall metal structure, dubbed the Beacon of Freedom, is a major milestone for the project. Marcia Warren, who's been with the project since its inception as one of the founding members of the advisory board, said it took us years and years to raise the $6.5 million that we needed. Warren is the former director of the Paul Green Foundation. In 2000, the foundation had come to the realization that North Carolina was in need of a monument to honor and celebrate the African American experience unique to the state. A realization that ultimately catalyzed the decades-long process of what has now become Freedom Park. The beacon, along with the rest of the monument, was designed by renowned architect Phil Freelon of Perkins and Will in 2016, after his team completed the recently dedicated Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Freeland was chosen to design the park to be, quote, a testament of truth about our past and a beacon of optimism about our future. The acclaimed architect died from ALS in 2019. But even after choosing an architect and acquiring the necessary funding for the park project, several unforeseen delays occurred, further pushing back the park's completion. At one point, a major steam pipe was found to be buried below the site, and shortly thereafter, an archaeological site was discovered during the digs, unearthing remains of the home of Thomas Devereux Hogg, a businessman who had enslaved 18 people. The site was then contained and excavated by state archaeologists. Warren says it just took a long time, but she was pleased to have come so far. Reginald Hodges, chair of the construction committee on the Freedom Park Board of Directors, has been on the project since 2004. Quote, when Freeland started putting together what the beacon could look like, he had several different interpretations. I'm really glad that we chose the 2 points to be going in similar directions. Freeland said that if you're going to do a symbolism of a flame comes out in different directions, but ultimately that does not reflect unity. What we have here shows you the flame, but it also shows you unity. The symbolism of this is the flame that burns in black people to be free, which has been passed on from generation to generation. That's what it means. Hodges fell quiet, letting his words settle in. Along the walls surrounding the beacon will be 140 molded panels that will have inscribed on them quotes from African Americans beginning from as early as the 1700s and running all the way up until 2020, the last of the quotes being "I Can't Breathe" by George Floyd. Hodges continues, "When people talk about this being a park that honors the African American struggle for freedom, that's probably the wrong way of saying it. More accurately, this park is honoring black North Carolinians." And he explains, "Everyone depicted in here is a North Carolinian, George Floyd included. He was from Fayetteville. There's going to be a quote on the wall that reads, 'The struggle for freedom begins every morning.' You don't need great people to make quotes like that." Hodges says the board members wanted to make sure some of the quotes were very simple, so that younger students coming in could understand the meaning on the wall. Warren seconds the importance the monument will have on educating students. She says, "This is about the school kids who come to Raleigh every year to study North Carolina history. We wanted to level the playing field. You have the old Capitol grounds with statues of white supremacist governors and Confederate soldiers, while more than 25% of our kids who come here are African American. In the past 5 years, fervent national movements have demanded the removal of Confederate monuments, with 73 removed or renamed last year alone. While these monuments in themselves don't rectify a long history of paying homage to slaveholders, there is hope that in the construction of monuments such as Freedom Park will allow for new generations to better grapple with the nation's tumultuous past, bringing unity where there is division. As advisors and board members stand below a canopy of 200-year-old oaks at the future site of Freedom Park, Hildebrand speaks with conviction. Our call is to make sure that the torch that is symbolized by that beacon never goes out, that the struggle for freedom continues. When people come to this park, they're not just learning about history, although they are, but that they are also being inspired for what will go on in the future." Well, I think I have time for a couple of theater reviews. The first review by Byron Woods, in fact, both of them are from Byron Woods, "The Power Brokers, From All the Way to Richard III. 4 significant local productions." Well, I'll see what I have time. First, in a November 1963 conversation with Martin Luther King Jr., the activist Stanley Levison described Lyndon B. Johnson as, quote, "a Southern politician who spent his entire life trying to be president. For the first time, he can do whatever he wants." But All the Way, playwright Robert Schenken's gritty panoramic drama about Johnson's first year as president, underscores how wrong Levison was. The brisk and occasionally breathtaking production at the Justice Theater Project reminds us of the few moves available to Johnson in his delicate, high-stakes dance across the minefield of issues that threatened to rip America apart after the assassination of John Kennedy. In retrospect, it's amazing that this brusque, earthy legislator nimbly threaded among civil rights leaders, segregationist Southerners, senators, liberal legislators, and the press, not only keeping the fabric of American society from unraveling, but enacting profound social change with the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964. Under Brooke North's direction, artistic director Jerry Sipp's riveting, supersized performance as Johnson captures the contradictory facets of his personality. We see an idealist devoted to realizing the Kennedy administration's loftiest goals, which Johnston would extend in his own Great Society initiatives, and dismantling a racism deeply entrenched in Southern culture and politics. We also see a manipulative, ruthless politician adept at the Texas twist, the coarse and callous realpolitik of cutthroat governance at the highest level. Before observing, there's no place for nice in a knife fight, Johnson notes. Politics is war, period. You're not running for office, you're running for your life. As Johnson stands toe-to-toe with 1960s icons, including partisan FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and future Vice President Hubert Humphrey, we also witness, through the FBI's covert bugging of social activists, the divisions that challenge the civil rights movement. The impatience of young activists Stokely Carmichael and Bob Moses manifest in growing arguments with NAACP leaders, including King and Roy Wilkins. Their direct actions on the subject and subsequent Mississippi Freedom Summer Project, whose efforts to register blacks to vote resulted in 35 burned churches and 3 activist deaths, is depicted in an electrifying funeral scene. The split among the leaders is made plain when Congress of Racial Equality David Dennis interrupts King's eulogy with a call for action. If you go back home and sit down and take what these white men in Mississippi are doing to us and don't do something about it, then God damn your souls, stand up. It is deeply jarring when Johnson seeks a modulated level of federal intervention in Mississippi afterward, one that doesn't provoke open revolt among Southern politicians weeks before the Democratic convention where he's running to be his party's candidate. It also reflects a conventional and disturbing political reality. It's hard to effect change as a politician if you can't get elected. History shows that Johnson got the Voting Rights Act passed in August of 1965, less than a year after being elected. In a theatrical version of a cinematic split screen, Schenckens underlines the similarities in Dr. King's acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize and a speech in New Orleans where Johnson made plain his stand on civil rights. Quote, whatever your views are, we have a constitution, a new law of the land, a civil rights law, and you can vote for me or vote against me, but I signed it, and by God, I'm going to enforce it. Still, Schenckens' script and Sipp's performance don't smooth most of the rough edges of a leader who was largely unapologetic for the road he took. He acknowledges the quantum imperfections, horse trading, arm twisting, and backroom deals that are a part of the political process when he knowingly asks the audience in a closing monologue, did it make you feel a little squeamish? Do you have to look away sometimes? He pauses before concluding, this is how new things are born. And the columnist Byron Woods gives this production 4 stars out of 4. The second 4-star review, a great big woolly mammoth thawing from the ice, is at the Burning Coal Theater just through October the 16th. That's ending this weekend. It's best to know whom you're traveling with before heading into the Alaskan outback. In the suspenseful world premiere of British playwright Tati Hennessy's tautly written drama, the wilderness experience destabilizes relationships among a superbly directed and acted quartet. First, Cree spirit Leah, acted by A.C. Donahue, an environmental activist on a third date with Justin, Matt Hager. A rich Silicon Valley tech developer learns that Jim, the opinionated father of their trail guide Chris, is a longtime oil rigger on the Alaskan pipeline. Then, we learn Austin's been hiding something about the time Jim, an impressive Gene Corden, really starts losing patience with Chris, Penn Apple, as jealousy, economic desperation, and differences in class and age further alienate the characters from each other. We learn that 60 miles away from civilization is no place to renegotiate a relationship, much less rewrite the social contract. Still, the abrupt ending made us feel we'd only seen the first 2 acts of a 3-act play. That's also 4 stars, and so is this short paragraph about Richard III, played by Sweet T. Shakespeare at William Peace University in Raleigh. That's through October 16th. Believe it or not, a sociopath can rise to the highest peak of power in a country. All it takes is money, connections, and a willingness to lie and manipulate people's deep-seated prejudices and fears. In the title role, David Henderson's deeply dimensional Richard repeatedly breaks the fourth wall to convey to us his cunning as he gulls the credulous, including Michael Foley's Clarence. Director Wade Newhouse sees in the widowed Queen Elizabeth not a woman fooled by Richard's power-motivated wooing, but one with no allies or protection after her husband's death. Designer Denise Schumacher's intriguing costumes outfit an ensemble featuring strong performances by Aaron Alderman as the shady Buckingham, Riz Harp's murderer, and Sean Schneider's Richmond. But when the cast started walking out through Richard's last soliloquy, we wondered if we should follow suit. And I only have a moment to tell you about a food and drink article written by Lena Geller called In With the Old. The Durham restaurant, famous Nana's, has a new owner, Matt Kelly, who wants to bring the legendary restaurant back to life and back to its golden era. When I arrive at Nana's, the front door is locked, as it has been for the past 3 years. I'm here to interview Matt Kelly. And she finds her way, Lena Geller, into the kitchen and finds Kelly. The first decade of his culinary career would amount to a lifetime's worth of achievements for the average chef. In the late 90s, shortly after graduating from culinary school, he landed a job at the Inn in Little Washington, one of the most lauded restaurants in the world. And after moving to the Triangle a few years later, worked stints at fine dining establishments Four Square and Farrington House before being promoted from chef to co-owner at French Bistro Vin Rouge in Durham. Well, I must close this broadcast, or this podcast, for the ncreadingservice.org because I've run out of time. There's a couple of articles. Just recall that you can replay this by going to our website, ncreadingservice.org, and look for the Listen tab and find this, particularly if you're interested in all those websites and voting addresses and phone numbers that I presented earlier in the program. So John Federson for the NC Reading Service saying thank you for listening, and I'll be back in a week with the next issue of the Indie Week. Bye-bye.